You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up in our right-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Professor Edward T. Burton of the University of Virginia Economics Department spoke on the current economic crisis at a Senior Statesman of Virginia Forum on January 14, 2008. Professor Burton is a well-known economic expert who is a frequent guest on WINA. He is the former head of Virginia Retirement System and is the author of the Burton Finance blog. His past positions include head of investment banking and municipal finance at Interstate Johnson Lane from 1994 to 1995, president of Rothschild Financial Services Incorporated from 1987 to 1994, senior vice president of Smith Barney from 1975 to 1984, and assistant and associate professor of economics at Cornell University from 1969 to 1979. The topic of today's presentation is The Financial Crisis. Which inning are we in? Bill Davis, SSV board member and secretary, moderated today's program.
On behalf of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, I want to welcome everybody here. We've got an excellent crowd. I'm the secretary of Senior Statesmen as well as the moderator today for our program. Any of you all who are not members of SSV, I want you to know we're delighted to have you for membership. I'll give you a little sales pitch. It's only $15 a year, and that gets you notified of all of our programs. We meet every month except for July, and we're meeting here at the Senior Center, we have really very outstanding programs. Now, our program today is obviously you all are aware of it, very interested in it, but we are delighted to have, I'm delighted and honored to introduce our program. Professor Edwin Burton is a professor of economics at the University of Virginia. He's a very, very, very well-known economist. He appears on WINA quite often. Many of you have heard him do that. He is former head of Virginia Retirement System. He has a distinguished background both in academia and in business. He is a graduate in economics from Rice University. His PhD is in economics from Northwestern University. And he's currently, as I said earlier, professor of economics at the University of Virginia. He's a trustee in the Virginia Retirement System. His past positions include head of investment banking and municipal finance for Interstate Johnson Lane, president of Rothschild Financial Services, senior VP of Smith Barney, where he was head of option sales and trading, and assistant and associate professor of economics at Cornell University. So it really is my pleasure and honor to introduce Professor Ed Burton.
Good afternoon. Let me see if I can get this where it works. I usually wander around when I talk, so can I pull it out? I can wander around with it? All right. Well, at the moment, I'll stay where I am, and then I'll wander out, but thanks for the suggestion. It's a great pleasure to be here. Can you all hear me all right? Today is January 14th, and we're in the midst of a series of life-changing events in the financial world and the economic world. And the date is fairly significant for me because it's my father's birthday. He died a number of years ago, but if we were alive today, he'd be 92 years old today if he were alive today. But I'm reminded that when he was 12 years old in the spring of 1929, the stock market was hitting all-time highs and he was being chauffeur-driven to school and living a good life. His father had made some money in the oil business in Texas. His father had been a judge in Carolina. And they'd moved the family to Texas. And he was living the good life, thinking about college days and all the good things are going to happen. Later that year, the stock market had the first of a series of catastrophic collapses. The stock market had traded as high as 380 in July of 1929, and it had a tough time in October, the great crash, but it actually rallied some by the end of the year and was still trading north of 200 by the end of 1929. Unemployment at that point was about 9% at the end of 1929. But as the next 3 years unfolded, unemployment would grow to be 25% by the time he reached 16 years old and was ready to leave high school and go to college. And the Dow Jones had fallen all the way to 40. It lost 90% of its value over that four-year period. And unemployment, which reached 25%, would average 20% over the next 7 years. Even as late as 1938, the unemployment rate in the United States was over 20%. So that ushered in the worst financial time in our history, and my poor father, by the time he was 16 in 1933, gave up all dreams of ever going to college, which he never did. Some miraculous way he became a lawyer later due to some strange quirks in Texas law. Which my father took advantage of. My mother's sitting right over here on the second row. So she fared better. Her father was a professor. At the time, I believe you were actually in France, Mother. My mom is from France. So anyway, January 14th is an important day to me because it's the anniversary of my father's birth, and I'll always remember it, and it never goes by without me remembering my father. So I'm delighted to be here with all of you today. To talk about the current financial crisis, which has been linked back to the Great Depression. And I want to say just at the outset, without giving away the story, I think that link is not correct. I think we're nowhere near the kind of situation that was faced in the Great Depression. And over the next 30 minutes or so, I'd like to talk about why that is the case. Let me first trace what has happened in a small outline. The current problems that we have in the economy surfaced in 2007. They were not problems that started last fall, in the fall of 2008. In fact, if you took the most frequently mentioned cause of the problem, the subprime lending crisis, that's a problem that surfaced in 2006. 100 subprime lenders went bankrupt in 2006. The second largest subprime lender declared bankruptcy in April of 2007. That was New Century Financial. And the largest subprime lender, which was Washington Mutual, was known to be staggering as early as 2007, early 2007. So subprime lending is not something that started 6 months ago to get in trouble, or a year ago. In fact, most of the bad news that was known about that was in 2007. Now, that's an important date to remember, early 2007, because if you ask yourself, well, okay, so subprime lending collapsed. Then in the summer, most of the credit markets got in trouble, the summer of 2007. And the kind of credit markets that got in trouble are pretty complicated. They're newfangled credit markets that are hard to understand. But strangely enough, a lot of those instruments sit in money market funds. They're not big percentages of it. But a lot of the kind of credit markets that froze up in the summer of 07 became commonplace in university endowments and mutual funds and all over the place. But they were never a big part of it. So even you probably own some of that, and you probably even lost money in it, but you may not even know because it was such a small percentage of the fund that you own. But the economy could feel the effects of the credit markets getting in trouble. The lending markets got in trouble. And they got in trouble in the summer of 07. Now, if you take these two facts together, the subprime lending market getting in trouble in early 07, and then many other areas of the credit market staggering in the summer of 07, what would you expect to happen? Well, the stock market started the year in 07 in the roughly 13,000 area, And it sort of traded around, nervous about what was happening in subprime lending, nervous about what was happening in the credit markets. And then in the fall of 2007, the stock market, knowing all about subprime losses, knowing all about the credit markets freezing up, went to an all-time high. The all-time high in the Dow Jones was set on October 9th, 2007, 14,160. Not only that, the firms most affected by the credit markets were Wall Street firms. Because what you had here was a classic housing bust. And every time we have a housing bust in the United States, what happens? People that loan money to housing go poof. Now, last time this happened, it was the SNL. You remember the great SNL debacle of the early 90s? Savings and loan associations were the primary lenders to the housing market and the commercial market, and they blew up in early 1990s. Well, this time Wall Street got involved. And some Wall Street firms were good at mortgage lending and good at securitization and so forth. And who were they? Well, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs. Who was not any good at it? Well, they tried, but they weren't very good at it. Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, they did everything they could to get into those businesses, but they just weren't any good at it. Well, in late October of 2007, after the Dow Jones had hit its all-time high, all of those firms hit their all-time highs also. Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers reported earnings, for example, in September of 2007. They reported third quarter earnings after everyone was scared to death that the credit crisis was going to affect them. And Lehman Brothers showed improved earnings. They had actually done very well. Goldman showed record earnings, Goldman Sachs. So the Wall Street firms looked like they were doing just marvelously. Now, people were still nervous about Merrill Lynch because as subprime lending went over the cliff, Merrill Lynch decided to really make a major push into subprime lending in early 2007. Yes, they wanted to get into this market. It looked mighty good to them. And led by Stanley O'Neill, they marched forward into the subprime lending area. And, of course, they were left to it pretty much on their own because the other people were all falling by the wayside in a state of collapse. So in the fall of 2007, roughly about 15 months ago, things could not have looked better in financial markets. Stocks were at all-time highs. The Dow Jones was still at 14,000 by the end of October. Goldman Sachs traded at $157 a share. Lehman Brothers was north of $60 a share. It was just the best of all worlds for stocks, not so good for bonds. And for the credit markets, the situation was getting increasingly worse. The housing market had turned down in late 2006. It went steadily down throughout 2007. And all the credit relating to housing was coming apart. Now, it was obvious in the fall of 2007 that there was major trouble in the credit markets. And yet the stock market ignored it. And one other group of folks ignored it. Where was Mr. Bernanke and where were Mr. Paulson when this was going on? Well, Bernanke had been appointed chairman of the Federal Reserve in early 2007. As you know, before Bernanke, there was Greenspan, and he had been a long-serving Fed chairman, not the longest-serving. Some of you may remember a longer-serving Fed chairman, McChesney Martin, who served longer than Greenspan. But Greenspan served for 20 years. He was originally appointed in 1987 by Ronald Reagan and then was reappointed by Clinton and Bush's until 2007. And before him was Paul Volcker. Bernanke was relatively new in his job in 2007. And throughout 2007, he continued to make statements that the economy looks good, inflation is our major concern. There may be some mild problems in the credit markets, but we need not worry about them. And he continued to make these statements through October and November of 2007 as the credit markets were completely falling apart. And there was really no doubt that that was happening. You could even see it in Wall Street layoffs. Wall Street was beginning to lay off entire sections of their credit departments and bond departments because there was no origination in that market. so that you knew that loan availability was drying up dramatically in residential mortgages and commercial mortgages and lending areas everywhere. But it was lost on the Federal Reserve, and it was lost on Secretary Paulson. Briefly, Secretary Paulson made an effort to get different investment banks to come together and take all the bad assets off the books privately, and there was no enthusiasm by the Wall Street firms to do that, so he abandoned that project in late 2007. So as we go into 2008, the Dow Jones is trading at about 12,500 to 13,000 area. The market's not down much. Everything seems okay, but the credit market is a disaster, a complete, total disaster. And Wall Street firms, while they were putting on a good face, were in shambles. Let me backtrack to Lehman Brothers for a moment. Lehman Brothers was the fourth largest pure investment bank in America. The largest was Morgan Stanley. The largest was Merrill Lynch. Second largest was Morgan Stanley. Third largest was Goldman Sachs. Fourth largest was Lehman. And the fifth largest was Bear Stearns. Lehman Brothers was what I would call a one-trick pony in Wall Street. The one business they knew well was structured debt. Now, I don't want to get off into a detailed analysis of structured debt. We could spend 10 hours talking about what it is. Just think of a bond that's hard to understand, and that should suffice. And believe me, they are hard to understand. Lehman was the expert at this. They were better at this than anybody else. They led the street in originations of the most arcane forms of this. And so in September, when this market had totally ground to a halt, the one business they knew well, they released earnings and said all was well. Staggering. There's no way that could have been true. That's like saying that some car dealer, for example, here in Charlottesville, announcing they're having record sales this month. You wouldn't buy that. But the street bought it. The street believed that Lehman Brothers, which was really a one-trick pony, and their pony had died months before, was still doing extremely well. And what about Goldman Sachs? Goldman Sachs had $800 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheet. $800 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. And they told the street, we don't have a problem. We hedged it all. And I remember watching CNBC, and they said, well, there's Goldman. Those guys are so smart. They did it again. They're brilliant. They hedged their mortgage backs. No one asked, how do you hedge $800 billion worth of mortgage backs? What exactly is it you do? That question never came up. Believe me, it's impossible, number one, to hedge $800 billion worth of mortgage backs. But worse, it's not possible to even hedge $20 billion without somebody knowing you're there. The street would have been rife with stories about Goldman hedging their mortgage backs if they were hedging any significant amount. They weren't doing that. So the two main indicators of earnings were Lehman and Goldman, and they told very positive reports. Now, Merrill Lynch and Citigroup weren't as positive. But as you got to the end of 07, there was a feeling that everything was fine. Bernanke was under pressure to do something. Because there was some concern about the credit markets, but Bernanke said there's no reason to do anything. And over again in early 2008, Bernanke held press conferences saying we're doing absolutely nothing till our regularly scheduled meeting at the end of January of 08. And at that time, there were great fears that the credit market was coming apart in the United States and in Europe as well. But the policymakers didn't do anything. And so when Martin Luther King Day arrived in January, it was a trading holiday in the United States. The U.S. markets weren't open. And what Bernanke and Paulson did on that day is they sat in front of their computers. They've got Reuters machines that tell them what all the markets are doing all around the world. So Bernanke pulled up a chair and a cup of coffee, and he sat in front of that computer in the morning, and guess what he saw? He saw the European markets collapsing. And he was afraid the American markets might collapse the next day. So having done nothing for well over a year, Bernanke called an emergency meeting of the Open Market Committee that afternoon on a holiday, The meeting took place at 6 o'clock, and they cut the target funds rate 75 basis points, or 0.75 point, and guaranteed to the public that they would cut it another 50 basis points the following week. The Fed, for the first time, took action. Now, this action was pretty much irrelevant by this time and didn't matter because the funds rate was already trading near zero, so cutting their target didn't really change any real interest rates. But it showed the Fed had finally recognized there was a crisis. But notice how the Fed recognized the crisis. They recognized a crisis in the equity market, but they had been oblivious to the crisis in the credit market. Now, I have long wondered about that. And as you trace this crisis, you will find that policymakers react to the stock market, but never reacted to the credit markets. And if you think that's gone away, let me toss this out. Right now, the credit markets are improving dramatically. Do they know that? Do they react to that? No. And how would you know that? How would you know that the credit markets are getting better or worse? Well, throughout 07, as the credit markets deteriorated badly, no one really knew. People in the markets knew, and people in the business world knew, but the policymakers apparently didn't. And if you feel that Bernanke and Paulson are people that really know what they're doing, let's look at their background. Bernanke was an academic. He had served briefly on the Federal Reserve Board. He had never spent any time in Wall Street trading areas. He knew absolutely nothing about the credit markets at all. He certainly couldn't define an asset-backed security, which is where most of the problems were. So Bernanke was completely unqualified to understand or assess the problems in the credit markets. What about Paulson? Wasn't he a Wall Streeter, a Goldman guy? Paulson was from Chicago. He was an investment banker in Chicago. He was basically a sales guy, and he only came to New York when he was made number two to Corzine at Goldman Sachs, which was just 5 years before he became Secretary of the Treasury. He had zero experience in the credit markets, had almost no understanding at all about what was happening in the credit markets. So these are the two key guys who are in position to do something. And it's not surprising that when the credit markets collapsed in 07, they did nothing at all because it wasn't clear to them. But let me give you another analogy. My favorite book in the last 20 years is a book by Michael Lewis called Moneyball. That book sits on every reading list of every course I teach at the University of Virginia. And if you have a chance, you should buy a copy of Moneyball and read it. Moneyball is about baseball. And it came about because of a conversation that Michael Lewis had a number of years ago. Congress at one point wanted to force revenue sharing onto baseball. You have revenue sharing in football. And Congress felt like it wasn't fair for some of the teams like Tampa Bay to compete with the New York Yankees because they couldn't pay the big salaries. They didn't have the big advertising dollars coming in. So that baseball should start sharing revenue so the smaller teams could compete. So they formed a committee. Congress set up a committee of people to study revenue sharing for baseball. Believe it or not, this was the genesis of this book. And so they said, okay, we can see that the teams that don't have the money, they can't compete. Well, one of the people on the committee was Paul Volcker, a name you've heard before and you'll hear again. Volcker said, well, what about the Oakland Athletics? They don't have any money and they win the pennant every year. And the chairman of the committee said, well, they're an exception. And Volcker said, no, they're not. They're not that many baseball teams. And they win it every single year. And they're going to keep winning it. By the way, they still win it every single year. Well, Lewis heard about this. And so he went out and spent a year and a half with the Oakland Athletics to figure out how they won. And he found out that baseball teams hired the wrong players. That in fact, if you thought seriously about how to win baseball games, you wouldn't have the same players that you hire. And so the Yankees may be paying the top dollar and getting all these great athletes, but Oakland ended up with players that had webbed feet, broken legs, and this and that, but they knew how to play baseball. And the most amazing story in the book is at one point the Oakland Athletics went after a player on one of the other teams who was a batting 219. He was a lifetime 219 hitter, which for those of you who aren't baseball fans, that's not very impressive. Guy just wasn't a good hitter at all. And they paid top dollar to get this guy, brought him into Oakland, and put him as their second batter in the lineup. Made him the number two batter in the lineup. Put him in there. And he continued to bat 220. Never did any better. He was a crummy hitter. People would ask Oakland, why are you doing that? Well, Oakland noticed that when he was in the lineup, it took 20 pitches on average to get him out. They almost always got him out, but the pitcher wore himself out getting this guy out. So they didn't care if he hit or not. He could knock the starting pitcher out. Well, that was kind of the mentality the Oakland Athletics had. Well, one of the things they discovered, you start a pitcher, he usually can't finish the whole game. So you have what are called relief pitchers. You have your starting pitcher, and he does great, but he eventually tires out because some 220 hitter takes 20 pitches to get out. So you've got this starting pitcher, he goes out, and then you have relievers. And the first reliever you have is called a mid-reliever. He comes in the middle of the game. So you have mid-relievers, and then you have savers. Those are the guys that come at the very end. They come in, like some of you may remember Goose Gossage of Yankee fame. They come in at the last minute. They're two outs away from victory, and they strike out those two guys, and they get a save. You get a save whenever you're ahead and you still win the game, then that pitcher gets a save. But a mid-reliever, he gets no glory. He often doesn't either win or lose. So if you have mid-relievers, there are no statistics on them. But if you have savers, you count up the number of saves. So each week as you go through baseball season, who's leading the nation in saves? This guy. Who's second? This guy. But you don't have anything for mid-relievers. But what the Oakland Athletics found out was that the mid-relievers are more important than the savers. They're really the important guys, because by the time you get to the ninth inning, the game is over. You need guys who can pitch from inning 5 to inning 8 and keep you in the game. But since they don't count any statistics that you can measure and talk about, mid-relievers had no real premium in the market. A saver costs 3 times as much as a mid-reliever. So the Oakland Athletics started selling all their savers and buying mid-relievers. And the lesson in that is that it was the statistic, the ability to measure it, that made it have value and bring it to people's attention. Now, I think that analogy carries over into this crisis. There is no simple measure like the Dow. When CNBC or anybody else talks about whether the market had a good day or a bad day, they're talking about the stock market. And they're talking typically about the Dow Jones Industrial Average because it's easy to measure. When people say the market was up 100 today or down 100, what are you thinking? You're thinking the Dow Jones. You don't even think the S&P. But if the credit market does better, how do you find that out? What is the measure that the credit market is getting better? In the last 3 weeks, there's been a major rally in corporate bonds and high-yield debt. How many of you knew that coming in here? Hardly anybody. But you know the stock market's off to a stumbling beginning. You know that because you measure that. And yet probably most of you own more fixed income than you own equities. Maybe not. But we don't have a regular measure. We don't have a save for credit markets. So the result is when the credit markets freeze up, nobody really knows it. The people in the markets know it, and people that depend on it know it. But sadly, the policymakers don't know it. And the policymakers did not know it here. If the policymakers had thought about this problem in 07, we probably would have never suffered an 08. And instead, Bernanke and Paulson reacted to the stock market. And the stock market was not a very good indicator of the bond market. In fact, it was almost a counterindicator because the stock market rallied to an all-time high as it became obvious the credit market was totally freezing up. Now, sooner or later, when a market like the credit market freezes up, it's going to affect everything, and sooner or later it did. And the first gong of the bell, the first one that really made a big noise, was on March 14th of 2008, Bear Stearns went bankrupt. It was assisted in the process, and a sale to J.P. Morgan was orchestrated by the feds, and the government guaranteed $29 billion of their assets if J.P. Morgan would simply buy them. But that was the first gong and the problems that were going to come. Now, as soon as Bear Stearns went bankrupt, immediately the feeling was, well, that's the end of it. Everything's fine. We're off to the races. And you even had statements like that from Bernanke and Paulson, that things will be fine. And then we get into the summer of 2008. The stock market's about 12,000, 12,500. It's down a little bit, but nothing big. This is just 7 months ago. And then all of a sudden, people started wondering about Fannie and Freddie. Well, what are Fannie and Freddie? If you go back to the 30s, there was great concern in the 30s by the Roosevelt administration that there were a lot of foreclosures going on. And in fact, there were. There were 250,000 foreclosures in the 30s. And that's a big number, except that there were 30 million homes. So it doesn't get to 1% of the number of homes. And by the way, you won't get to 1% in this crisis either. Why? Well, first of all, 30% of all homes in the U.S. don't even have a mortgage. Another 40% have mortgages that are so small that foreclosure is not even an issue. Most of the problem is confined in the other 30%, and most of that is confined to people who bought their homes in 05, 06, 07. So while the mortgage crisis is serious, it's not evenly spread at all through the environment. It's pretty much concentrated in just a few places. So as the problem developed in the fall and they were faced with having to deal with the situation, Fannie and Freddie in the 30s, the government authorized Fannie Mae to buy mortgages. It was originally the Federal Housing Administration. So Fannie Mae was created to buy mortgages, but it was a government institution. Fannie Mae originally was a U.S. government, and so they bought low-income housing mortgages. And they did that until 1968, and then President Johnson, nervous about the size of the debt, the way Fannie would do that is Fannie would sell bonds to the public, take the cash, and buy mortgages from banks who issued the mortgages. So that's what Fannie did. But that debt was considered U.S. government debt. President Johnson in 1968 didn't want that as part of the debt, so he privatized, privatized Fannie Mae in 1968. So they became a so-called private entity, but most people who bought their debt thought it was government debt. It was so-called agency debt. So Fannie continued to do what it's always done. It sold bonds to the public. People bought their bonds, and then they bought mortgages. But now they were private. They traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And for a bizarre set of reasons, Freddie Mac was created 4 years later, some said to compete with Fannie Mae, whatever that means. But by the time you get to the summer of 08, Fannie and Freddie own more than half of all the mortgages in the United States, $5.3 trillion, in fact. And they were sort of private companies. Now, Bear Stearns had been levered 70 to 1, and they went down the drain. Lehman was levered 35 to 1. What was the situation at Fannie and Freddie? If you count the mortgages that they guaranteed, their leverage rate was 135 to 1. They had no hope. In June and July, as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stock started trading down, everybody got in the act to praise how creditworthy they were. Bernanke said, "These two will never fail." Direct quote from July of 2008. Paulson said, "They're crucial to the housing market. They're no danger." Chris Dodd took the podium to announce that they were as safe as can be and people should not worry about the sanctity of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Hardly anyone got left out of this. Everyone praised them, even the Wall Street firms. Wall Street firms, Lehman Brothers analysts, recommended Fannie and Freddie in July when the stocks were 25. They would be below 3 in 2 months. So one group after another stepped forward to talk about how great Fannie and Freddie were. Well, as the summer of 08 wore on, Fannie and Freddie got in increasingly more trouble. Their stock went down, down, down. And now the rating agencies began to think there may be a problem with their debt. Well, you wonder, well, why didn't they just let them go bankrupt? Why didn't they do something? And thus far in this crisis, the Treasury and the Fed had taken the position that we are not going to use taxpayer dollars to bail out people's mistakes. Yeah, we helped Bear Stearns a little. But basically, the government's going to play hands-off in this deal. And they approached Fannie and Freddie with that attitude in mind. The only problem was that if you looked at who owned Fannie and Freddie debt, and who was in jeopardy. Half of all Fannie and Freddie debt had been sold to foreign countries. And the Treasury was increasingly nervous that if foreign countries got uncomfortable with Fannie and Freddie debt, they'd quit buying U.S. Treasuries. But even if you looked at the debt sold in the U.S., the biggest single owner of Fannie and Freddie debt were insurance companies, and a small handful of insurance companies at that. So if Fannie and Freddie went under, you'd probably lose five or six of the largest insurance companies in America in the process. So there was increasing pressure on the Treasury and the Fed to do something about it. So in early September, and this is when the financial crisis that we know of really began. In early September, the Dow Jones is still trading around 12,000. Everything looks kind of normal, but the credit markets have completely frozen up. And Fannie and Freddie are in dire straits. Their stocks have traded down to virtually nothing. And so on September 5th, which is a... can't remember what day that was now. September, I used to know the exact dates of all this. September 4th or 5th, the Treasury took Fannie and Freddie into receivership and effectively guaranteed their debt. They kind of punished the equity holders, but they took over Fannie and Freddie. And then this was the great exception. We're not going to do any bailing out or any of that. And Bernanke made it very clear that the Fed was not going to be doing any bailing out, and they're not going to do a thing. Now, as the week unfolded, Lehman Brothers stock started falling. Lehman has about a billion shares outstanding, and they started the week at $20 a share, which is $20 billion. The interesting thing about Lehman is actually kind of a sad story. When Lehman traded at 65, there were a billion shares outstanding, so that made them worth $65 billion. One-third of all that stock was owned by Lehman employees. When it got down to $20 a share, one-third of that $20 billion was owned by Lehman employees. And Lehman employees mostly never sold their stock. They went down with the ship, virtually all the Lehman employees. There was very little selling of the stock. So one-third of that loss was Lehman employees. So Lehman began to get in trouble, and by the end of the week, they couldn't meet cash. They ran out of cash. They had all kind of problems. They were subject to downgrades and so forth. So you had the famous weekend of September 13 and 14. And that was the weekend where they have three decisions on the table. Do we save Lehman or not? What's going to happen to Merrill Lynch? Because Merrill was worried they'd be next. And AIG was on the ropes, the biggest, largest insurance company in America. So the first question was Lehman. And there were two firms that wanted to buy Lehman, Barclays and Bank of America. But Bank of America had noticed that some of Lehman's assets were non-income producing. They were raw land in California that had no interest income at all and were probably worthless. So Bank of America walked away. They said, we don't want to buy Lehman. But Barclays did. And Barclays had noticed that the Fed had helped J.P. Morgan buy Bear Stearns, so Barclays assumed that the Fed would help them buy Lehman Brothers. So Barclays met with Lehman, formulated a buyout of Lehman, and they had the Fed represented by Tim Geithner, the secretary designate of the Treasury. And Geithner said, I'm sorry, there's no appetite for a bailout. And Barclays said, well, won't you help us at all? Won't you guarantee some of the Lehman assets like you did in Bear Stearns? Geithner said, no, we've done that for the last time. There'll never be another bailout. There'll never be another taxpayer thing at all. It's over. And they checked with Bernanke, said the same thing, and Paulson went on television, said the same thing. So throughout that weekend, the official government position is we're not going to do anything. Meantime, AIG had been downgraded. Now, the significance of being downgraded, if you're an insurance company with a lot of contracts out there, is that you have to come up with more cash collateral. In AIG's case, they needed $85 billion by Tuesday at 4 o'clock. If they didn't get $85 billion by Tuesday at 4 o'clock, they were going to have to file for bankruptcy. So the Fed said, nope, we're not doing it. We're not helping you. You just have to file for bankruptcy. So you get into Sunday. Lehman is still on the ropes, and the Fed will not help. And so Lehman says, okay, they call in the lawyers preparing to file for bankruptcy. Meantime, Merrill Lynch is so scared that Merrill Lynch calls up Bank America and agrees to sell their company to Bank America. And that leaves AIG. AIG doesn't know what to do. So Monday comes, Lehman Brothers files for bankruptcy at 2 o'clock in the morning on September 15th. Merrill Lynch announces it's selling itself to Bank America, and AIG is begging the Fed for $85 billion. So the first day that news hits, the market did not have a very good day. It was down 500 and some points on that news. And then the next day is the AIG day. So AIG, every 15 minutes, AIG went to the Fed, starting at early in the morning. But by 2:30, they went to the Fed and said, we need $85 billion by 4. Nope, you can't have it. And then they went back 2:45. We need $85 billion by 4. You can't have it. Went back at 3. We need $85 billion by 4. This went on and on until a quarter to 3. And at a quarter to 3, Bernanke said, yeah, you can have it, and whatever else you want, too. So AIG was given $85 billion because they were so scared of what would happen. And then from that moment on, it was bailout city. Now, the following week, or really later that week, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs looked like they were on the ropes. And it was that afternoon that Paulson made an abrupt shift and announced the TARP program. Paulson, who 5 days earlier had said, we are not going to use any taxpayer money in this crisis. 5 days later, he advocates spending $700 billion in the TARP program. And by the way, Congress needs to pass this in 48 hours. So he went from nothing needs to be done to something needs to be done immediately and in huge size. Now, ironically, that pattern on Paulson's behalf will continue. Eventually, that bill passed on October 3rd. The president signed it on the 4th, and 2 days later on the 6th, Paulson said, oh, we didn't need to do that after all. The $700 billion TARP program was 100% abandoned, and instead they used the first half of that money to make direct equity injections into the broker-dealers. Had they sold it to Congress on that, it would never have passed. Congress would never have supported making the direct equity injections. Instead, they sold it as a provision to buy bad assets and to get trading going in those assets in the marketplace. So the pivotal period really is right after, I guess, the AIG decision. Once they made the AIG decision, then from that day forward, there was a plan a day. Every day there was something new. We've got to protect the commercial paper market. We've got to raise the FDIC guarantees. We've got to go out and buy mortgages. Every day it's like Bernanke woke up in a whole new world every day and could find something where he needed a federal guarantee to go forward. And Paulson pretty much the same. Even the politicians chimed in. When TARP got voted down, which it did on September 30th, there was an amazing coalition in the House of Representatives. Two-thirds of House Republicans, including our dear Virgil Goode, who's no longer in Congress, maybe this is why, I don't know, he voted against TARP. Two-thirds of the House Republicans voted against TARP, but so also did the Black Coalition of Democrats and the Hispanic Coalition. That was the coalition that put it together. The Black Democrats, the Hispanic Democrats, and the House Republicans beat that bill back. And even when they got final passage on October 3rd, that same group, all of those groups voted no on average. There just were less of them. But the Black and Hispanic caucus among Democrats voted no on final passage, and the House Republicans voted no. But the president supported the bill, and the standard bearer of the Republican Party, in the week it was being voted, decided to cancel his campaign in a great flurry of statesmanship, I guess, and flew back to the Congress and who knows, but he changed his mind and then had a debate with his opposition the next day. I think wisely Obama said nothing, which was the right thing to do, I think. And he has continued that habit. But the disarray was obvious. And from that point on, Bernanke and Paulson proceeded to change policy with every shift of the wind. And the stock market just collapsed. On October 1st, when it was clear TARP would pass, the Dow Jones was 10,800. That's October 1st. That's 2 weeks after Lehman had failed. October 1st of last year. 10,800 is where the Dow was. 6 days later, it had the worst 6 days in financial history. Absolutely the worst 6 days in financial history are the market closing days between October 1 and October 10. On October 10, at Friday in the morning, the Dow Jones traded at 7,800, down 3,000 points in six business days. And after that, the market was the wildest roller coaster ride you've ever seen. It went all the way down to 7,800 again. It even rallied all the way to 9,600. You remember what day that was? They called that the Obama bounce. It was Election Day. Election Day at 4 p.m., the Dow Jones hit 9,600, and everyone was excited. And then it went cratering back down. Now, the volatility of the market in October and November was record-setting. Never in American history has the market traded like that. And then by the end of November, it quieted down. Since the end of November, the market has been relatively quiet. It hasn't been rallying a lot, but it has rallied, by the way. The market today is somewhere, who knows, 83, 8400, but the market has been much quieter compared to the period in October and November. And so now looking back, well, let me look forward for a moment. What's the real economy been doing while this is going on? Well, in 08, in spring of 08, we all thought we had a serious energy problem. When we'd fill up at the pump, we were looking at $4 prices for gasoline. The price of oil was $155. There's a lot of concern about that. That seems to have dissipated lately with oil coming down to $35 a barrel and the price of gasoline at the local pump being $1.60. But last year, it looked like we had the worst of all worlds. We had a major energy crisis. We had credit markets collapsing. So now where are we? Well, that October 1st date that I keep going back to, that also coincided with the collapse in retail sales. Just at that point, at least at the high end, the Nordstrom's and the Neiman Marcus's of the world, their sales just totally collapsed. In fact, the first part of the crisis hit relatively wealthy people much harder because they are the ones who own stocks and bonds and so forth. And so sales began to drop dramatically. Walmart reported good sales. Walmart was doing fine in that period. But sooner or later, everything got hit. Whatever you sold, people didn't want to buy after October 1st. So unemployment now, which had been relatively low, now began to pick up dramatically. Job losses began to pick up dramatically. And this most recent job loss number is the biggest one we've seen. Over 500,000 jobs disappeared from the American economy last month. So we are now seriously in a recession. Unemployment rate is 7.2%. Now, you will hear that that's the worst unemployment rate since whatever. That 7.2 is only mildly higher than the average of the Clinton years. So be careful about overinterpreting it. It's also an unemployment rate that any European country would give anything to have, even if briefly. Those countries are typically in the double-digit range for unemployment, so anything that smacks of 7.2 looks good. Where will this go? It'll get higher. Unemployment will probably hit 8.5%, and probably it'll hit it relatively quickly. That'll happen probably within the next 2 or 3 months, and that probably is as bad as unemployment will get during this particular crisis. You're a good ways along toward the bottom. What about the financial markets? The worst is probably over there. No one will say that, but it probably is over. The stock market probably did bottom at 7,800, and the credit markets are already beginning to show improvement, dramatic improvement, surprisingly. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have the kind of credit markets we had 5 years ago, because that's or 3 years ago, because those were unusual and probably not even sensible. But the credit markets are beginning to return, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. You don't see that because they don't measure it. And the stock market can't even feel it for some reason. Stock market is behaving sort of weirdly given the underlying improvement that's taking place in the credit market. But the real economy, the unemployment numbers and so forth, are going to get a little worse, as they always do. Don't forget that unemployment in 1979-81 was over 12%. So getting to 8.5% is nowhere even close to that. In fact, unemployment got above 9% and pushed 10% in that 1989-91 period. So far from this being the Great Depression, this isn't even as serious a recession as we saw in 79-81 or 89-91. It might get there, but there's nothing to indicate so far that it's even remotely there. So the economy will get worse in here a little. My own guess is that stocks and bonds have probably seen their lows. Don't rush out and buy things. I'm notoriously wrong about all kind of matters. But what are we looking at down the road? Well, we live in a different kind of world than people lived in the 20s. It's really not good to analogize the current situation to 1929. This is a very different world with pockets of strength that didn't exist then. If you look at Asia, for example, there's no stopping Asia. Those economies are going to be strong with or without us. But the fact that they are strong are good for us. That's very good for us. If you look at Europe, you now have Eastern European economies that used to be sitting behind the Iron Curtain that have a lot of strength and could provide a lot of strength in the future. Poland, for example, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, for example. Even countries like Turkey, which were moribund for years, have shown a lot of strength. So you're in a world where your neighbors are much better healed than they were in the 30s. Now, there is one thing that could hurt that. If international trade, which has been so important to the growth of the world economy in recent years, if that hits a skid, or if protectionism takes hold, then that could really have a serious adverse effect. I don't think it will. You know, I am not particularly a fan of our new president-elect. I like him a lot, but I didn't vote for him. But my sense, every time he makes a decision here, it seems to be one that I approve of. One of my students wrote me an email the other day. My students are always curious since my views are a little different than what most academics' views are. They asked me what I thought of Obama so far in his appointments, and I said, well, except for Secretary of State, I think he deserves an A+. And I was particularly pleased with Paul Volcker, who I've mentioned several times in this talk, who I think is one of the greatest public statesmen in this country has. And I'm pleased to see that he's the number one economic advisor to the new president. I think Larry Summers is a man of courage and conviction, a smart economist. He's the new Secretary of the Treasury, and I think Obama's made a great choice there. I think Geithner, Treasury Secretary, is a great choice. So my sense is Obama is going to not be a protectionist, that he'll stand up to some of his union cohorts on this issue and see the great virtue of international trade. I think he'll do that. So I have more confidence today in our new president than I had. Before. I think he's made a lot of good decisions. So I didn't vote for the guy, but I think thus far he gets an A+ in my book for appointments and so forth. What's that? Except for Secretary of State. I don't want to get off into that. Well, I think that, you know, I have a blog, and one of the things I mentioned on my blog for New Year's resolutions is that those two would come to blows by the end of the year. It's hard to imagine that. Now, let me say something about the stimulus package. And again, here, I've got to give Obama a pretty good grade. I'm totally against the stimulus package, no doubt. But realism is realism. There's going to be a stimulus package. And originally, they were talking $700 billion, you know, and I can just see people spend $700 billion digging holes and filling them back up and thinking we're doing ourselves some good infrastructure or whatever. But Obama has come out for spending half of the money on the payroll tax rollback. I think that's terrific. If you cut taxes for average workers, then they can spend the money and they can buy the things they want. So I'm convinced that at least they will enjoy the fruits of that, and as opposed to what the government might end up spending. So I think Obama's made a huge concession to people like me who don't like stimulus plans, by putting half of it in the form of a tax cut. I think that's a big effort to reach a compromise with his Republican opponents. And I would urge the Republicans to accept that, hold your nose and accept that package, because that's, believe me, given who's in Congress now, that's going to be the best you're going to be able to get out of that Congress. And I applaud the president-elect for trying to, you know, he's got the votes to do what he wants. And the fact that he's willing to make that kind of concession to the opponents, I think, is very praiseworthy. Now, here's the problem with the stimulus, though. Well, let me give you the good part. The good part is that if Congress passes the stimulus, and if it's a consensus vote, then people will think it works. You want people to think it works. I'd like to fool all of you into thinking it works. Because if you think it works, it'll work. If you don't think it works, it won't. Because the whole idea is to instill confidence. So, to the extent everybody says, oh, look, they passed the stimulus, now we're going to be fine, the economy's going to be great, and then you go out and act accordingly, then everything will be fine. But here's why it's really not a very good idea. When we teach undergraduates about fiscal policy and tax policy, we draw a diagram up on the board, and we say, if the economy has big unemployment, then here's what we ought to do. Cut taxes and raise spending and blah, 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 blah. But we assume you can do that instantaneously. We assume that at the time the spending takes place, that's when you need it to take place. But let's look at the current situation. When did the recession begin? December of 07. When did we learn that? In December of 08. So 1 year after the recession began, we now realize there's a recession. Now, if Congress votes the stimulus package, when will it take place? Well, the spending will all take place in 2010 and 2011. Virtually none of it will take place in 09. Let's hope not. Because if it takes place in 09, it means they haven't thought out what they're spending it on. So the spending will hit when the economy itself will be on the road to recovery anyway. It hits at exactly the wrong time. The right time for the spending to take place was a year ago. That's when we needed the spending, when the economy was coming apart. That's why countercyclical policy almost never works. Because by the time you realize you should do something, it's too late. And if you try to do something with fiscal policy now, it has an impact when you don't need it. And that's what will happen here. What will happen here is, let's assume it works the way it's supposed to work, it will work in 2010 and 2011, by which time the economy is already moving along. Well, that creates huge problems. Now you've got massive inflation problems, problems with the dollar. You're now going to have to deal with an overheated economy. That sounds weird now, doesn't it? But to the extent it works, that's the problem you'll have. But here's the problem with all this, and I always am amused that I have these crazy views that aren't exactly the same as the policymakers. But just imagine if you were Obama and you came back from a meeting with Professor Burton and you saw the light. And so you went to your first press conference and you said, well, I just had a meeting with Professor Burton. Oh, so what's our stimulus package going to be? Well, he said we shouldn't do anything. He's not going to do that. And he can't, and politically, he can't do it. You can't expect people to do that. And a little bit, that's the problem with having presidents and congressmen overseeing the economy. They can't just say, let it heal itself. That's just not one of the possible programs. So when you look at what administration proposes, what you want is this, a proposal that does the least harm, really, because almost anything they're going to propose is going to do some damage. And I think that in that respect, as much as I don't want to endorse the stimulus, and I don't think it's a good idea, I would urge my Republican pals to probably go ahead and vote for a package that's half tax cuts and half infrastructure spending and try to put as many controls in it as they can. I think it'll come too late, but it probably can do not so much harm. The American economy is a strong economy. Even nationalizing the banking system will not slow it down. It may mean that Citigroup is not going to become the Citigroup of old. It's probably going to be a moribund institution. Anybody that takes a whole lot of government funds is probably in that shape. But I think our future actually looks pretty good. I think the financial markets have seen the worst. That doesn't mean they're going to run off and rally. You've got plenty of time to buy them. You'll have many opportunities. I think the economy will see worse times. We will see another couple of bad months, and we'll see more layoffs here in Charlottesville. We'll see more layoffs other places. But this too shall pass, and I think by the time we get into summer, we'll already see housing having stabilized in most areas of the country. It will not have stabilized in Las Vegas, in Florida, in Nevada, or Arizona, or California, but it will have stabilized in the great Midwest. It will have stabilized here in Virginia. And I think better things are ahead for the housing market. And starting in the second half of this year, the economy will look better. And I think the financial markets will look better. But you're going to see some very bad news the next 2 or 3 months. And you're going to see things here in your own community of people that are struggling with liquidity issues and so forth, because that's going to continue to be a little bit of this crisis. But I think, in general, you can't hold back a very powerful economy like the U.S., and you've got a world economy that can't be held back either. I'm sometimes reminded of this by my Asian students that I have increasingly at the University of Virginia. These kids are so talented and so aggressive and so hungry that you know when they go back to their home countries, they're going to They're going to be pulling some mighty heavy oars. These are good things, by the way. It's wonderful to see other parts of the world doing well. It's always best to live in a neighborhood where your neighbors are doing well. That's always a plus. You don't want to cheer for your neighbor not to do well. You want to cheer for your neighbor to do well, because that, in the long run, is better for you. Thank you.
Well, Ed, thank you so much. That was absolutely a fabulous talk. And I don't know about everybody here, but I sure feel a little bit better about things. Could you take a few questions? Okay, we'd like to have some questions. And I ask everybody, it's a very complicated subject, but I ask you to try to keep your questions as short as possible. We'll start over here.
With regard to the amount of government taking over certain things, helping out the country, how do you relate that with socialism?
Well, that's a good question. The question that Mary has posed is isn't this just socialism, basically? That's the heart of the problem is, for example, the banking system now is not really free to do what it wants. If you're Citigroup, now you have an overseer telling you how to lend money. And what Citigroup needs to do is lend money that makes sense. They need to make the smart loans. They don't need to make loans that the government thinks are appropriate. So that's going to be a problem. And that's why I think the banking sector is going to come out of this not in great shape. I would not want to be running Citigroup at the moment and having to deal with the problems. And if you look at what's happened to Citigroup, they have now taken on $52 billion worth of debt, in effect, since October from the government at 8%. So they now owe $4.16 billion in interest to the U.S. government every single year that they didn't owe October 1st. And not only that, Barney Franks and Chris Dodd are going to tell them how they should be lending the money. And by the way, they're not interested in lending it to creditworthy people. That's not their idea. They want to lend it to people who may not be the best credits. So you're in a very difficult spot. They also want to tell you how to pay your employees. Even if you don't like executive compensation, if the government's the one that's going to tell you how to pay your employees, it's going to be a very different kind of a operation. Now, I think away from financial services, this is not going to be a big problem. You'll see financial services splinter. There'll be a whole lot of small investment banks come into existence. That'll be the future of the industry. And then things like Citibank will become traditional banks, and hopefully someday they'll get the government out of their way. But for a while, for the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to have the government dictating a lot of lending policy by banks, and that's not good. There'll be a lot of money wasted in that. There'll be money wasted in the stimulus package, and there'll be money wasted in the financial services. But in the long, great scheme of things, Mary, it's not going to be that big a percentage. Because if you look at what gets produced, it's stuff like, what are everybody buying in these households now? They're buying things that didn't exist years ago, iPods, cell phones, and that's where the world is headed.
Hi, could you speak to the risk of inflation?
Well, the risk of inflation is huge. The question was the risk of inflation. The key thing that you should watch, if you can watch it, is the yield on 3-month Treasury bills. Once that starts going back up, it's very low now. It's under 10 basis points, under 0.1%. But once that starts going up, say above 0.5%, that's a sign that fear is receding in the economy. And then you're going to have to start worrying about inflation because the Federal Reserve has dramatically increased its balance sheet. Translated, it's printing a lot of money. Now, so far, velocity in the economy has been very light. There's not much lending coming out of the banking system. That will change as the economy begins to improve. So the big problem, say, 2.5-3 years from now, will be inflation and how do you combat it? And it's going to be political, inevitably, because there'll be people saying the Fed shouldn't do anything about it and so forth. So the problem of the future is the problem with the dollar, the problem with American credit, the government's credit, not company credit, but the U.S. government's credit, and the problem with inflation.
You talked about Paulson and Bernanke not being able to follow what was happening. Why aren't there measures to record the credit area that you talked about?
That's a great question. The question is, why aren't there some simple measures to know what's going on in the credit markets? That's actually something I'm quite interested in pursuing. And I will personally be working on that myself, because it's obvious to me that whatever you can measure and put on the news gets attention, and whatever you can't measure and put on the news doesn't get attention. And that's made this crisis much worse than it ever needed to have been. Had the Fed and the Treasury, and particularly the Fed, provided significant liquidity to the banking system in 07, I don't think we'd have the crisis we have today. But they didn't. Bernanke saw no reason to do that. He took no steps to do that until as late as September of 2008. That's the first time Bernanke added sufficient reserves to the system, liquidity reserves. And they will ultimately it will solve the problem, but he came at it way too late. And we're paying a huge price for Bernanke's inability to recognize the credit crisis. So we do need those measures.
We established the Fed to guide our economy, and a year ago you said they should act. What have we learned from that, and what do we do to not have this happen again?
Well, there are a lot of parts to this story. One part I left out is, why did Wall Street get in such terrible shape? I just kind of brushed over the fact that they owned a lot of mortgage backs, but why? Why did these firms take such huge gambles? And I think we need to think about that and think about corporate governance of these companies and what we do. So I think there are a lot of issues, a lot of mistakes were made. But the great tragedy of policy is that the policies we've implemented have tended to reward bad behavior and punish good behavior. If you fix the mortgage for somebody that's having trouble making their mortgage, they may have taken out too big a mortgage that they couldn't afford, whereas their next-door neighbor acted rationally and took out a sensible mortgage. And you're going to tax the rational person who did the right thing and give money to the person who did the wrong thing. That's bad policy. I mean, it may appeal at the moment, but long run, it encourages bad behavior. So we need to think about the bad behavior that materialized in this. But as far as Fed policy, whenever you have a tightening in the credit markets of any serious type, the Fed should be pushing very hard on what's called quantitative easing. They should be flooding the system with cash reserves to ease liquidity problems, because a problem in one part of the credit markets will spread to other parts of the credit markets, and that's what happened. When you have trouble borrowing over here, then you're going to go over here, and you're going to go over here, and so all these markets start getting frozen up one after another. The Fed has to intervene right away at the signs of that. That's what the Fed's for. That is what it's for. And the Fed refused to act, I think largely because I don't think Bernanke knew what he was doing. I hate to say that. He's one of the best economists in the world, and he's 10 times smarter than I am. I'm sure his IQ is twice mine. But he missed this one. He missed this one big time. He will go down as one of the worst Fed chairmen in history, in my opinion. I just think we need to think of the Fed as a provider of liquidity when the system needs liquidity, and it didn't do it. And that is the right answer. When the system needs liquidity, now it ought to take it away later. For example, if we get an inflationary spiral in 2 or 3 years, the Fed's got to step up and go the other way. And if it doesn't, we're going to have the problems we had in the 1970s. And believe me, there's a political motive to do that. If you look at the size of the national debt, how do you get around the national debt? Inflation. You're going to reduce the value of the national debt with inflation. There'll be a strong tendency of policymakers to want to do that, but they have to resist that.
Several questions arise to me, but I would like to ask on one question. And I agree with almost all of your expressions that you made about where the market stands today. And I agree also with the idea of having some kind of measurement of our credit markets. But that's the second aspect that disturbs me, because not your comments, but the fact that the credit market today, in credit cards, where do we stand? Because as one person told me, whom I heard speak recently, everybody's pussyfooting around the issue of credit card debt.
Well, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with credit card debt. The forecasts are not encouraging, but Congress is again fiddling around with credit card debt. They're in the process of passing a law that says you can't alter the interest rate on existing credit card holders. And not only that, you can't change the terms knowing that they've defaulted on some other credit card. In other words, you can only set the terms for that person depending on how they did with the credit card you issued them. Well, if you're in the credit, put yourself in the position of the guy giving out the credit cards. If you put all those restrictions on, the only way they can compensate for that is by raising rates. So you're actually going to force credit card companies to raise the rates on the average borrower. Congress should stay out of the business of trying to regulate the rates of credit cards and leave that to the market. And it also deny a lot of people credit cards. The harder and harder you make it to loan money, the more you beat up so-called predatory lenders and so forth, the more they'll quit being predatory lenders. They'll quit being lenders to the people that need it the most. So, but I don't think there's any evidence so far that credit card debt problems are going to be any worse than forecast. They're forecast to be pretty bad, but that's in the marketplace.
I wonder if you could say a word about another sector of the economy, and that is municipal bonds. How you think they fit into this pattern, and what you think their prospects are.
Was it municipal bonds? Is that
yes.
What you said? Municipal bonds often, they're not default free, as we know. They're not U.S. Treasury. They're obligations of state and city governments and so forth. And there have been defaults in municipal bonds, not only recently, but historically. The city of Detroit defaulted, for example, in the 30s. And there have been defaults in California. Several California counties have defaulted just in the last 12 months. There'll be more defaults. By the way, Detroit might come up for an anniversary default. They're in such a mess. They're not risk-free in the sense that they can default. So if you own municipals, you want to be sure that whoever is issuing them is pretty safe. Now, one of the things that happened in the municipal market is there used to be insurance companies that would guarantee them. There were specialty firms that would guarantee municipal bonds. Those firms have all gone kablooey. So I'd be careful. Municipal bonds are pretty safe. It's rare when you have a default, but it is possible. New York City almost defaulted in 1975. They came in within a whisker of defaulting in 1975.
I recall Japan's debt as a percent of their GNP is maybe 130%. Ours maybe 75%. What do you see as kind of a practical upper limit for the United States?
I don't know, Tom. I would have thought it would be lower than 75%. I think once you get in this stratosphere, you need to be thinking about how to get it down. I don't think there is a comfortable level up this high. Any more than if I ask you that about your own personal debt as a percentage of income or something, that number, you want to get it as low as you can. And I think that's true for the U.S.
You didn't mention the securitization by the investment banks on the type of mortgages that were being made, ninjas, where there was no penalty. I mean, financial institutions making mortgages to people with no income and no job, and then the investment bankers purchasing them without ever knowing what was in the package, even including automobile loans and credit card debt within a mortgage package of securitization, and nobody ever looked inside the package, just buying what the interest rates were. And this is what, you know, caused the credit problem.
Well, I wouldn't say that it caused it, but it certainly, everything Tom McQueeney back there is saying is true. There were a lot of loans made that shouldn't have been made, and so-called liar loans and all that. And Tom, the people that made them paid a pretty good price. I mean, Lehman Brothers was a big player there. How'd they do? Bear Stearns was a big player there. How'd they do? WaMu was a big player there. I mean, it's not as if the people that made the loans didn't pay a pretty healthy price for making them. They did. The institutions just went kablooey.
Nothing has been mentioned about the size of our national debt and the continuing program of increasing debt and decreasing taxes. Now, the trickle-down theory of tax cuts may work if you exclude tax cuts for the upper stratum of the income earners. The trickle-down theory basically works in numbers. Once people have taken care of basic necessities, the size of the tax cut is more important to people who are earning, say, $50,000 or less than it is to people who are earning in excess of $250,000 or more. And my question addresses the issue of the fact that in the past we have never decreased taxes in the marginal rates when there was a war going on, which we have had going on for quite a while now. On the contrary, at that point in time, taxes, particularly on the marginal higher income brackets, have been increased. And eventually, just as it has in the regular credit markets, something's got to give, which is the government's inability to pay its bills without printing money. And you already alluded to the fact that we are printing some money. What we don't need at any time, whether now or later, is galloping inflation, such as Germany experienced in the mid-20s.
There are several issues hiding in that question. Let me just point to a couple of things. One is, one of the numbers that I watch is the percentage of GDP that's the government. That number has hovered between 19% and 21% for a number of years. It dipped somewhat in the Reagan years and then kind of came up a little bit in the Bush years and was steady in the Clinton years. And the Clinton years were a period of fiscal responsibility, amazingly enough. Not so for the Bush years, I hate to say. That number looks like it's going to 24% or 25%. Based on the current spending program. So that would be a major acceleration of the role of government in the U.S. So that's one issue. And as government spending becomes that big a percentage, then it's got to be paid for with something, either bonds or taxes. The second issue on taxes is, if you look at the personal income tax, the reason that's always an issue of the rich is that's basically who pays the taxes. The vast bulk of taxes are paid by high-income, personal income taxes are paid by high-income taxpayers. But if you look at the plight of the average guy, it's not very good. The average guy and average person in Virginia makes $45,000 a year. That's his base compensation, $45,000. He's paying between $6,000 and $6,500 in payroll taxes alone, some of which he pays directly and some of which he doesn't get because the employer doesn't give it to him. Now put his property tax on top of that, plus sales tax, plus Virginia income tax and federal income tax, he's lucky to walk away with half of his income after he pays all these various tax agents. And he's not rich at all. He's not in very good shape at all. So the tax burden, even on the average guy and less, is enormous in this country. Because once you factor in state and local and everything, it's huge. Now it's not as big as it is in Europe. We can make it even bigger. but government has become a very big animal. I mean, one of the interesting in the 30s, the reason Roosevelt really couldn't do much with stimulus is the government was too small. Tripling government expenditures didn't have much impact because the government was so tiny. It just didn't even matter. Now we don't have that issue. Small increases in government spending do matter because the government is so much bigger. And the great tragedy is when you raise the role of government like that, it never recedes. It becomes acceptable and you move on. So you hit 24% and maybe the next stage is 30%. And the more you go, the more you freeze out private enterprise and the more government becomes the... I would rate that as a bigger fear than the fear of deficits, the fear that the government's role in the economy is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They're both scary, though.
One of the features of this whole thing that disturbed me a lot was the behavior of the rating agencies like Moody's and S&P, who rate bonds and other entities, corporate ratings. It appears to me they just plain lied, and it appears that they have a conflict of interest. In effect, the rating agencies benefited from telling incorrect stories about these securities, like rating them AAA or high ratings when they didn't deserve those ratings, and the rating agencies were in pay of the people issuing the securities. Seems to me that kind of irresponsibility ought to be severely punished.
You know, that's an interesting dynamic. Many years ago, well, I shouldn't say many years ago, 2001, I went to Bermuda to a conference on asset-backed securities. And there you had two kinds of people. You had the Wall Streeters who were packaging these securitized tranches and so forth. And they were all wearing three-piece suits and Harvard MBAs, and they looked great, you know, and they got up on the podium. I didn't understand anything they were talking about, but they looked the part. They were just great. And then I saw these little matronly-looking ladies and men so forth sitting in the audience who were not dressed so well and were from Des Moines, Iowa, or worked for some insurance company or something. And I wondered why they were watching this. And so then I went and talked to them. They were the buyers of this stuff. They worked for insurance companies or state pension funds, and they were listening to all these masters of the universe describe all this. And so I thought, well, why would you ever do this? So I asked him, why would you buy this stuff? I can't understand what they're doing. I don't follow the waterfalls they're talking about. And they said, oh, well, they're highly rated. They got a AAA rating, and I can buy this stuff at whatever percent. The rating agencies were the go-between between the Wall Street masters of the universe and Joe Average buying securities for a mutual fund out there, or an insurance company. And who paid them? Rating agencies were paid by Wall Street. So you went to the rating agencies and you said, here, I've got this securitized tranche. If you'll put AAA on it, I can sell it for some yield. And they, what if they said no? Oh, you won't? Okay, well, there's another rating agency over here. I'll take my business over there. So the rating agencies were competing for business. And, you know, every time you put a AAA on, you got $500,000. And by the way, your bonus is 20% of that. Okay, so the guy comes in, you want to put a AAA rating on this and collect $200,000, or no, and collect zero? Well, guess what choice they made? And so the rating agencies, and you know what, again, Congress needs to step right up and take some credit here. Congress authorized the SEC to designate the rating agencies as the rating agencies for the debt market. So the SEC officially looked to the rating agencies. Had that not been the case, people wouldn't have done that. So the heavy hand of government really basically singled out the rating agencies who had a conflict of interest. I mean, the worst conflict of interest imaginable. You were being paid by the people selling the bonds. I think that will come to an end, but it is a great tragedy. And the rating agencies guys made a fortune. Oh, my goodness, to be a CEO of one of the rating agency companies. And, of course, the guys that did most of the damage are on their islands out in the Bahamas somewhere. Probably put everything in T-bills and are relaxing. But you're right. You singled out a real villain in this, the rating agencies. And the Wall Street firms that knowingly hired them and paid them are villains here also. They knew the conflict of interest was there.
Our last question. Just described in terms of the rating agencies is a manifestation of the same one underlying problem, and that is this intense drive to maximize your take and minimize the period over which you have it. You want the quickest return in the shortest possible time. That effort has led to all these excesses in terms of I can scarf off a fee for creating a mortgage that really has no life. I can give a rating that's not justified. How can you build in rewards for doing long-term right things to offset these short-term benefits that people perceive and get them doing bad things?
Well, I raised that issue a little earlier when I was talking about corporate governance and the way in which some of these decisions ended up getting made. I'm reminded, everyone sort of throws dirt at all the Wall Street guys, but I'm reminded of my students who would graduate at the University of Virginia with an art history major and economics, and maybe they'd come to class half the time and end up with a decent grade and get a job at Merrill Lynch. And the first year, they're salary plus bonus would be $150,000, and second year it'd be $250,000. And I would see them, $250,000. They had a $50,000 skill set, and they were getting paid $250,000 a year. And so I would see them at the end of second year. I'd be up in New York, and they'd all come to dinner, and I'd say, how are things? They'd say, that was just terrible. I didn't get as big a bonus. I should have made $300 this year. And I'm looking at these kids thinking, you know, if you lose this job, the next stop is McDonald's. It's because they don't have a real skill set that would command anything like this. So there was kind of a never-never world about it, and people began to think they're entitled to all these big packages. And Wall Streeters that were making $3 and $5 million would be irate. I can even tell you a story of a very close friend of mine who made $120 million in 2007, $120 million. And I was having lunch with him, and he was furious. I said, why are you so mad? He said, well, look what this guy made. He made $500 million, and that guy made $800 million. He was angry and upset. So, you know, this crisis is the tail end of a lot of foolishness. A lot of foolishness. A lot of people that believe silly things that just made no sense at the time. And hopefully in the future, we all learn. I mean, one person I know that never got hurt in the crisis is my mother sitting over here. She owns treasury bills and things like that, and wouldn't invest in anything remotely that could ever go down. And the reason is that in 1929, she was 9 years old. She lived through the 30s. She was a teenager in those years, and the last thing she purchased was in 1937, and nothing since. So my mom, the great miser here, she learned from the experience, and hopefully we will all learn from the experience as well. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.